Welcome to Profit Boss Radio. I'm Hillary Hendershot, your host. This is episode 82.
Profit Boss Radio is your weekly wealth mastermind. Profit Boss is also a community and a movement for women who are ready to take control of their money, break the glass ceiling, and give ourselves permission to finally have enough. Want the secrets of wealth to be yours? This is the place. I'm Hillary Hendershot. I'm a certified financial planner running a leading advisory firm for women, and I'm sharing with you real stories from real life and real women who are making it happen. Forget Wall Street. Let's do this, ladies.
People with a written financial plan are 60% more likely to increase their savings over time and twice as likely to stick to their savings plan than those who don't accomplish the simple step of just writing it down. Yet just 24% of Americans say they have a wealth plan in writing. I want us to change those statistics, and I've got an offer for you that's going to make it as easy as 1, 2, 3 for you to get your wealth plan in order. The first step to having a wealth plan is taking stock of what's already there. You have to know your net worth. You have to know where you're starting from in order to get to your destination. And knowing what your financial life looks like at a glance is the key. You can use a financial dashboard to manage your wealth plan, and I am giving you free access to the same financial dashboard I use with my most successful clients. A financial dashboard allows you to track your bank accounts, categorize your spending, track real estate and mortgages, including even knowing the difference between principal and interest, and your investments and your credit cards, and see it all at one place and at your fingertips. I think we can all agree that having one location, both on the web and on your mobile device, to view your entire financial picture saves you time and frustration. It also empowers you to take control. This is an exclusive offer for the Profit Boss audience. To take advantage, just go to hillaryhendershot.com/eMoney. This is the same technology I make available to my comprehensive financial planning clients. It has superior security with 256-bit secure socket layer encryption. They literally have a team of security experts trying to hack the system at all times, but no one has ever succeeded, and it's a VeriSign secure site. The portal itself is totally non-transactional, so no one can move, withdraw, or access your money. It just puts all the same data that's already online in one place so you can see it. You input your various passwords, and those are kept private and only ever accessible to you, sort of like mint.com, but with a lot more planning power. Full disclosure, I am the advisor behind the scenes. My team and I could potentially run across your account balances. But listen, those are visible to the folks at mint.com or Personal Capital or any other financial dashboard app you might be using. And I'm here because I truly want you to be successful, and I'm not going to do wrong by you. You can trust me and my team to safeguard your information. Having a wealth plan in place is one of the 7 key steps to wealth, and the eMoney Financial Dashboard is a powerful tool that makes that possible. Once you're logged in, interactive workshop tools can help you see how changes in savings and investments today affect your future retirement goals, and that really puts you in the driver's seat. I'm proud to offer you this tool, and I hope you take advantage of it now. To request access, please go to hillaryhendershot.com/eMoney. Welcome to Profit Boss Radio, episode 82. I'm here with Tim Cole. Tim is the founder and chief executive officer of the Compass Alliance. Over the course of his career, he's served in various senior level positions in the highly competitive pharmaceuticals industry. He played an instrumental role in the growth of a small Midwestern firm into one of the world's largest healthcare companies. But Tim isn't here to talk with us about his role as an executive in a healthcare company. He's actually here because he has authored a very deep and rich book. And if you listen to this show and you're interested in strategizing about how to have a really remarkable career, whatever that career is, I recommend that you pick up a copy of the Compass Alliance. We'll link to it in the show notes at hillaryhendershot.com/82. Tim has a wide range of experience across sales, marketing, human resources, training, market access, and leadership development. He survived and thrived in the face of 24 million restructures and 5 mergers. So if your industry is facing something like that, he's got knowledge for you. He's used his knowledge to mentor scores of individuals who have moved on to senior level roles, earning industry-wide praise. And I can say I've read reviews and testimonials for Tim online, and certainly the people who have come into contact with him and been coached by him verify he is the real deal. So he is one of the most highly respected veterans in the healthcare arena. He's also the winner of Excellence in Leadership Awards and has contributed to several books on leadership and the future of healthcare. Tim, welcome to Profit Boss Radio.
Thank you, Hillary. Thank you very much.
Tell me a little bit about the title of your book, The Compass Solution. How does the compass relate to someone who wants to have a remarkable career?
Well, I think it begins with, and I appreciate the introduction, in my own career, I realized after about the 3rd or 4th restructure and the downsizings that came along with that, that there came a point that if I was going to survive, I had to find markers. And as I began to identify those markers, over time, that became my version of a career compass. Once I'd found those cardinal points, I didn't have to rely quite as much on a manager or a supervisor or even the company. And so in many ways, I think that compass ended up being my solution for longevity in a very turbulent industry, one that's quite frankly changing and changing and continuing to change. And so when I began to think about this notion of a book, I realized at the cornerstone probably should be my own version of a career compass. And I called it The Compass Solution, A Guide to Winning Your Career, because in effect, that's what it was for me. When I found those markers, my path became infinitely simpler. And I was able to use that to leverage over almost 38 years in the healthcare pharmaceutical industry.
Well, and I think it's like anyone who becomes an expert in something, we develop. Now, mastering my career was not something I became an expert in at all. In fact, I ran screaming from corporate America, but we'll talk more about that later, is that you develop these philosophies that are actually more simple than complex. So what are the 4 cardinal points of the compass?
Well, you make a good point. It's very complicated to make things simple. And it took me a long time to realize it is. When I finally embraced that fact, I wanted to make things simple. And certainly the corporate world can make you want to run screaming into the night. But here's a simple explanation of the 4 cardinal points and the why behind them. The biggest and what became my lodestar, my North Star, was when I finally looked in the mirror one day and I realized I was on my 3rd manager, I was in my 4th or 5th structure, and I began to embrace the fact that, look, if I'm going to make it, the only person that's going to travel with me over the course of my career is me. And so I began to think about what's really involved in becoming personally accountable for everything that happens and learning how to respond to it. And in time, and I won't for the purposes of the interview go into great detail, but for me, the North Star for my career compass was just that, personal accountability. You know, how do you brand yourself as the primary product? How do you emerge from restructures? And how do you find a way, regardless of the circumstances, to still forge a path? And in the chapters in the book, The Compass Solution, I go into great detail about what's really involved in embracing this notion of personal accountability. Because ultimately, when you go into any kind of career, one of the things you have to come to grips with, it's not going to be always fair. It's not always going to be breaking the way you want. But when I began to embrace that, my path got a little bit simpler. So the first cardinal point is just that, personal accountability, which really is optimizing yourself. Over the years, I developed other cardinal points. The second cardinal point is people. I began to embrace the fact that, you know what, you can be really good as an individual agent, but if you don't optimize those around you, you're probably never going to realize your full potential, and the company's never going to realize its full potential. And so the second cardinal point was people, and all the chapters that support that really speak to when I work with people that were great in working with other people, what was it that made them great? And that's, I guess, for lack of a better term, some of the insider secrets that I share in the cardinal point or the chapters that support people. So you've got one cardinal point that talks about personal optimization. You've got a second that talks about optimizing the people around you. And then the third cardinal point I call process. And I have to explain that because people hear process and they think of systems and they think about how, you know, a machine works. Well, what I'm trying to say with that cardinal point is you've got to know how your company really works. How are decisions arrived at? How does a work product finally develop so that it either creates profitability for your company or creates a reason for it to be in existence. And so I began to think about, what did I see of the people that were experts on the process of how the organization worked? So if you stop and take a step back, the first cardinal point is optimizing self. The second cardinal point is optimizing the people around you. The third cardinal point is optimizing the company or companies that you work for. But then the fourth cardinal point, and I describe it this way, Hillary, it's the gyroscope that many people don't have that balances those three cardinal points with their personal life, with their emotional health, with their physical health, spiritual, whatever it might be. I began to realize that perspective, which is the fourth cardinal point, was the connector. And when I finally got those four put together, my path went from being extremely difficult to almost, I won't say it was a ride in the park. It wasn't. It was anything but. But my path suddenly became infinitely clearer. And I've used it for years. And that's what ultimately I used to build the book, The Compass Solution, A Guide to Winning Your Career.
Okay, this is rich. I want to ask you about all of that, but we have to do it one question at a time. So let's dig into, I'm a little concerned that this word personal accountability, maybe I'm too literal. So when you say personal accountability, it sounds, what I hear is responsibility, taking responsibility for your results, but then you use this word optimization. So what is personal accountability to you?
Yeah, well, personal accountability, let me offer a disclaimer first. I think some people hear that and they say, well, if it is going to be, it's entirely up to me. And that's not what I am trying to convey. What I'm trying to say to people, we are all gifted with a certain number of skills, aptitudes, and capacity to work. What I found is that the people that really were most successful realized early on that they had to optimize those skills, optimize those aptitudes, and balance that with a passion, finding a passion that they really could embrace that would give them a reason for working. So when I talk about personal accountability, what I'm really trying to say is that for the most part, a lot of people that I work with over the years never A, found something they were passionate about, and never B, never realized their full potential in terms of the skills and aptitudes. So everything I talk about with this notion of personal accountability is the notion of making you the best you can be. And you can't do that unless you find something that you're passionate about doing. And I work with hundreds, probably thousands, that never did.
So let's make this real for people. What did you find in your career that you were absolutely passionate about?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I can tell you, I started in sales. I went into management, loved both of the roles. But then in about my sixth year, I had some success as a line leader. I was invited to go into our management development training program and to actually run management and leadership development. That took me from being, I guess, a functional leader who understood the basics of management to really being able to delve into leadership and to begin to understand what do great leaders do, not just people that check the box, which probably in retrospect, I was more of a check the box kind of guy. So in my fourth or fifth job, I found myself running leadership development, and that changed everything for me. I found a passion. I found an interest that has stayed with me now for three decades. And I thank my lucky stars that by probably dumb luck, I found myself leading a program that absolutely gave me a fire that I'd never had before.
And can you give an example of a time? I mean, you must have managed dozens, if not hundreds of people. Can you give an example of a time you saw someone behave without personal accountability?
Oh, how much time do we have for the podcast?
Just pick your favorite.
Well, you know, I say in the book, and I really believe this, long before there was this term emotional intelligence, I began to realize that every one of us is equipped with two tools that we carry with us throughout our professional lives and really our lives in general. One is a magnifying glass and one is a mirror. For most of us, certainly for me, my magnifying glass was overly large. I could look at everything, everyone around me, and draw conclusions about it or them. But my mirror was, quite frankly, underdeveloped. I had a hard time looking at myself, asking myself tough questions, and quite frankly, looking critically at myself. So to answer your question, it's been my experience that the most advanced, emotionally intelligent professionals that I've worked with over my career managed to strike a balance between the mirror and the magnifying glass. And I have encountered scores of people who didn't even know they had a mirror. And because of it, they suffered greatly when it came to really looking at themselves critically, asking themselves tough questions, and in most cases, advancing in their jobs. More often than not, they blamed other people, the circumstances, the weather, the dog ate their homework, whatever it might be, but they never really took accountability for what they were responsible for. So yeah, more times than I probably care to try and bring up.
Well, I think certainly learning to look in the mirror and be honest about what you see or what others see in you is a life skill, but probably takes decades to hone. Let's talk about, your second point was about optimizing people. You make the point in the book that people should be loyal to people, not companies. And you also say that the people you chose to be loyal to ultimately really impacted the trajectory of your career. Can you tell us a story to illustrate what that loyalty looks like?
Yeah. In fact, a lot of people have asked me over the years, Hillary, how did you manage to remain loyal to one company? Because my company that I worked for went through 5 or 6 mergers, acquisitions. It changed so many times, 6 different cultures, 6 different ways of doing business. And someone asked me once, well, how did you stay loyal to a company through all that? And here's the simple answer. I didn't. I found early on that if I could build a network of colleagues who I respected, who I trusted, who I had respect for as regards their competencies, and I felt as if had my back and I had their back, that's where I built my loyalty. I always had, I think, a fairly objective look at the company. And I realized profits will change. A new CEO comes in, whatever it might be. And sometimes people are simply lopped away. And so I decided early on that I would form my loyalties to people who I worked with, that I trusted. And that network, more often than not, is what sustained me. And I can tell you, there have been numerous times you don't go through, as you mentioned in the introduction, you don't go through 24 plus restructures and manage to survive unless you have a network that you can reach out to say, what do you think? This is what I think. And those friends, even though I don't mention them as part of the title of the book, The Compass Solution, they actually ultimately helped write this book because they were the difference maker and they were the ones more often than not that allowed me to survive.
So you forged long-term productive relationships with folks, and then say a reorg or restructure is happening and your job might be going away, you're able to reach out into the organization and say, where is there another place for me? I'm just trying to kind of make this real.
Yeah, both. Where is there another place for me within the organization? Mm-hmm. But here's the amazing thing. As your network grows, I have the good fortune of having contacts throughout a big part of the healthcare industry. And so what I try to say to people is, look, you're a contracted free agent. You just don't know it when you go to work for a big company. So you treat that as a free agent would. You always look at options. You're always building your network so that, to your point, if the question is posed, wait a minute, if we restructure and I lose my job, is there another place in another department? Yeah, there could be. But it's okay to keep your options open with other companies because that network, more often than not, is going to be the best vehicle to find that new job, even if it doesn't happen to be within the confines of the company that you currently work for.
Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, and this, I really got this sense as I was reading the book, you recommend being very entrepreneurial. So it's a job. So people typically think of a corporate job like a safe place to just sit and sort of relax and do their job. But you're saying you need to think strategically probably throughout your career.
You do. There's no business equivalent to the tenure that an academic professor enjoys in the university. And you know that, and there's not. And I think, unfortunately, and I've blogged about this a few times, I've worked with a lot of people who seem to be almost mindlessly naive when it comes to, well, my job could go away. Well, yeah, your job could go away, and the chances are that it will. And you build a network and you build a proven track record so that if it does, you're not simply like a victim of a street mugging going, oh my gosh, what do I do? I talk about in one of my blogs this notion of severe career blindness. Severe career blindness is best evidenced when someone loses their job and their first statement is, well, gosh, I guess I'll have to start building a resume now. Are you kidding me? You know, and that happens every day. It happens every day. So you're right. I do treat it as an entrepreneurial type of experience. And I look at every job as simply a widget in the larger career path. But I want people to think strategically about their career. Don't think of it in the context of just the current job. Always look ahead two or three steps and be prepared to the possibility that the current job could end.
Mm. And let's talk about burnout. You make the point that mastering your career is not about working the most hours. So what are some practical steps people can take to avoid burnout?
Yeah, well, I think burnout is a phenomenon that's reaching incredible proportion right now. I was reading a Gallup study that came out last year that said, and I'm speaking just now to millennials, it said 71% of millennials, and this is a 2016 study, over a million respondents, 71% of them are not engaged, which is a frightening thought, not engaged in their current job. I think the reason—
What does that mean? They're bored?
They're bored and they're looking for a way out. Over 50% of them say, I'm going to be gone in the next year. So they're filling time and they're saying, you know, it's not what I want, but I'll maybe find it someday. And part of that is the nature of the job. And a lot of people, as you know, they go to work to pay a mortgage, to pay a car payment, just to have employment. But I think it's more than that. I think a lot of people apply the same level of strategic thinking to their career as their choice of craft beer on the weekend. And by that, I mean virtually none. They simply go to work and they wait and hope for good things to happen. So what I try to say to people is early on, I want you to think a little bit more critically about your job. I want you to think in larger context than the current source of employment. Think about what you want to be doing in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years. And here's what I think happens for a lot of people. And this goes back to your original question. Why do people burn out? Well, I think they're, in many cases, they haven't found what they're passionate about. Their skills aren't being optimized. They're simply, you know, doing a job to get the money to pay a bill. And at some point they begin to get disengaged. And the next step beyond disengagement is full flat out burnout. And so I do offer in the book, The Compass Solution, some suggestions on how to avoid burnout, because I think it's rampant and I fear that it's going to get worse before it gets better.
I think the thing that I've recently discovered is that putting vacations in the calendar first is life altering. So my vacations, I already have several vacations scheduled in 2018. And that's been, and we, my husband and I schedule what we call staycations, where we've agreed that neither of us will make plans on a particular weekend while out talking with the other. The idea is to stay home with the baby and just spend time. And that's been really rejuvenating. And I feel so good about it that I want to proselytize it to people. I can't believe it took me this long to figure it out.
Well, good for you, Hillary, because let me tell you what I've seen on the other extreme. And I've been in my career for 3+ decades. I can tell you I've known scores of people who didn't do what you just described, who often gave back vacation every year because, well, that's being a good corporate soldier. And at the end of their career, I can tell you no one comes to them and says, hey, John, thank you for giving back 2 months of your life in order to serve the company. And that's not being flippant in saying that, but you're right. A lot of people don't schedule vacation first. They should. In fact, as I'm talking to you, I'm right. I think I mentioned to you, I'm in Hilton Head with our extended family, which includes a new grandchild. And we make it a point every year to schedule and to prioritize that because that's by far the most important part of your life.
Well, thank you for spending part of your vacation with us.
This is great. I'm loving this. They exiled me to a bedroom where I could be less easily to hear. So I'm thrilled to be with you.
All right. So, you know, I think I to be honest with you, still have a little bit of PTSD from my last corporate job. You know, I'm very happy with what I'm doing, so I don't have regret about it. But I think the thing that always got to me, I worked for one of the largest organizations in the world. I won't mention their name, but I think the thing that always got to me the most when I had that job was the politics. I mean, it was, to me, it was sick, so dysfunctional. I was told what office events to attend, and it seemed like everybody thought the VP of this department was God, and people would sit around and strategize how to butter up to him or whatever that was. And there was even this common wisdom that apparently in any meeting where there were more than four people, somebody wins every meeting. And I thought, I can't play this game. I just can't do this. It sucked the soul out of me. So what advice do you have for people who work in organizations that have really dysfunctional rules?
Yeah, well, first of all, I don't think your experience is atypical. And I've heard the descriptor used, post-traumatic stress dysfunction disorder, and I think it's not quite like combat, but there are times, honestly, it feels like combat because many people are asked and or it's demanded that they sacrifice their values and their philosophies, and they're probably, Hillary, a lot of people like you that go, no, I can't do that for a career. And good for you, because that dysfunctionality, I think, is rampant in a big part of the corporate world. And I think your experiences are not atypical. Here's what I learned, and I talk about it. In fact, one of the chapters under the heading of process is all about the game of politics, because it is rampant. I have suggestions, and they're hard-earned suggestions of what I think people can do to navigate politics. I'll give you an example of my own life, because I had the same problem you did. You know, I won't say I'm outspoken, but I do have a set of values and philosophies that I believe in. And early on in my career, when I began to see what's a good term? Well, I'll tell you the term I use in my book, The Dance of the Toadies, which is the sycophants, the suck-ups, whatever you choose, word you want to choose, who basically their mission in life is to make the boss feel like he or she is godlike. And it killed me. I couldn't deal with it. So I decided early on, well, I'll just be apolitical. I will be like the business equivalent of Switzerland, and I won't play the game. That's not really a successful strategy, because there is no business equivalent of Switzerland in the business world.
Right,
being apolitical is a political position. So what I learned to do eventually was to basically make certain that I don't sacrifice my values and philosophies. I decided I'm going to make my work stand on its own merit. I will credit when credit is due, but I'm never going to subordinate myself for any leader at any level. And for the most part, I can look pretty comfortably in the mirror and go, I never played that game. And as a leader, as I became a leader, I was quick to pull the plug on people when they wanted to play the game with me. Because what I learned is that if someone behaves differently around the alpha, that person in most cases is simply playing a game. And so I talk about it in the book. In fact, some of the chapters, and I'll stop on that. But one of the first learnings I had when I was 3 years in the industry, a senior leader invited me out for a dinner. Now, I'm from a small town in Western North Carolina and not the most sophisticated, but this was a very fine restaurant. You know, the maitre d', the waiter, everything, it was first class. And I watched this gentleman treat everyone in that restaurant dismissively to the point that it was awkward. And then he turned to me and he turned on the charm. And I thought to myself, here's a guy who is going to demand that I at some point become one of the toadies. And I'm not going to do that. And I never work with that person because of it, because I realized this is the guy that actually plays the music that creates the dance of the toadies, which I use as the, you know, the ultimate suck up in the business world. So I think your experience is not atypical. It takes a tough-minded, strong individual to navigate through that, though.
Yeah, we would have customer offsites, and the senior executive would show up with not his wife, but his girlfriend. And yeah, there were, you know, 80 to 90 employees there. This was no secret. This was just how things were done. And there was the director of my department, I think when she took you under your wing, her wing, she would have these things she would do. She would stop by your desk and say, walk me to the bathroom, because that way you could get some face time with her while she wasn't at her desk. And then she would literally go into the stall and go to the bathroom while she was talking to you. And I felt that this was, I'm struggling to find the words, but it was like, this is what I think of you, Hillary. This is what this is the level you're at in my world, is I will deign to speak to you while I relieve myself. And I started declining. She would come by my desk and I would say, no, I'm not going to walk you to the bathroom. I didn't last long there.
Well, you know, the symbolism, I have to say, that may be one of the most overt symbols of inappropriate behavior and submissive or actually demanding submissive behavior that I've ever heard. That's one for the books, Hillary. That's amazing.
It's really odd, right?
I thought I've heard of everything. I've never heard of that.
Okay, so your brand of declining to participate in the politics, Tim, did you ever see women do this? And are women who decline to participate in politics received differently, or is that really a function of the quality of the organization?
Well, I think it's probably both. I think it's one of the things I've learned, because I've worked with some outstanding female counterparts, and it would be very easy for me to sit here as a male baby boomer and say, well, no, it's the same. I don't think it's the same. I think there are unique challenges for a female executive that I may think I know about but probably can't appreciate. So my answer is, I think it's probably both. I think that when you're talking strictly politics, I don't know that it's more difficult, but I can imagine in certain scenarios it could be. You know, I never saw examples of at least what I considered to be, for discussion's sake, for instance, sexual harassment, because I never worked in a culture that would allow that. But I think there's subtle forms of politics that could make it, in some cases, I think it could make it more difficult for a female executive. At least that's my estimate. I'm not a woman, so I can't say for sure, but I think it could be.
Okay. So you didn't really bring up the topic of sexual harassment, but you mentioned it. And I wanted to ask you about that because the recent Harvey Weinstein controversy, and, you know, it's really top of mind and it's being discussed by women everywhere now with the hashtag MeToo movement. And so as a seasoned executive, what advice do you have for women who might be experiencing some form of harassment and really are afraid to speak up because it might limit their career growth?
Yeah, it's funny watching the news. I've had friends, and my wife, Nancy, even said, you know, I'm sure this happens all the time. And I am certain in certain industries it does. I can say for the company or companies that I worked for early on, there was a standard set that said, you're not going to do this. And I think the culture was such that there was just a zero tolerance. And did it happen somewhere in departments maybe I wasn't a part of? Yes. But I can safely say, other than maybe in the first year or so, I'm not aware of ever seeing anything like that. My recommendation, to answer your question, I love the Me Too movement. I would encourage any female in the business world who feels as if she is being subjected to that to take the necessary steps, because I just don't think in most companies, if they're reputable, and I'm sure there are probably some that aren't, I just don't think there's any tolerance for it anymore. I think the risk that that individual, if they're the perpetrator, puts the company at in terms of just overall litigation, all the risk associated with it, are just, they're not going to be tolerated anymore. So I'm glad that in that, I guess, Hollywood industry, it's happening. I guess it happens more often than I'm probably aware of, but I would definitely recommend. And again, that's where, you know, we talked earlier about mentorship and networking. If in my company or any company, if an individual came to me and said, I'm not sure what to do with this, but this is what happened, I think a strong network and a strong mentor would say, we're going to HR today and let's find a way to get this thing resolved, because it's not going to be tolerated. And that may be, in some cases, the best way to approach it.
You know what I'm hearing, Tim, that you haven't actually articulated, and I'm not sure what came first, the cart or the horse, but it sounds to me like you worked for a good company. And I'm not sure if you, being a person of high values, selected that company, maybe consciously or unconsciously, but I guess what I'm hearing that's actionable for my audience is you have to be careful where you go to work. That there are bad organizations and there really are good ones where some of these problems, politics, harassment, are just less likely.
I think you're right. Yeah. I would like to say I had the strategic mindset that led me to a good company, because it was a good company and it has been a good company. But mine, Hillary, was the Forrest Gump approach to finding a career. And I admit that in the book.
Forrest Gump approach.
It really was. I got very lucky. I didn't know when I interviewed that I was going to work for a company with sound values. I hoped it would be, but I would definitely say to any prospective worker today, yeah, I would talk to people within that company. I'd find out what the culture is really like. You know, if you call four people in any company and say, give me the straight scoop, tell me what you like and what you don't like, I think a little bit of premeditation on it would probably save someone a lot of headache, because you're right. I guarantee there are companies out there that culturally people go, what am I here for? I can't stay. And in those situations, I talk about it in the book. You know, I have a chapter called Walking Away, 10 questions that I encourage an individual, if they're thinking about leaving, to go through, because I think in many cases people are in the wrong spot. And then when they are, they need to leave.
Well, yeah, this is your one precious life, right? And time is the only resource you can never get back. So,
that's exactly right. Yeah.
Just two more questions. You talk a lot about leadership, and I think this is a term people talk about a lot, but almost never define. So what is leadership to you?
I think leadership is effective influence. I think leadership, in my mind, and I said this not in the book, but in some of the articles I've written, I think if you're lucky, and in an entire course of a career, you'll meet three transformative leaders. Three. And maybe some people met more, maybe some meet less. But for me, leadership is the ability to influence others in a way that affects the heart and the head, not the hands and the feet. And most of the people you encounter, whether you're in an entrepreneurial role or in a major corporation, most of the people you encounter are transactional. You know, you do this, I'll reward you. That's transactional. Transformative is something much, much more. And what I encourage people to think about is, what do you have to do to become a transformative leader yourself? And it doesn't imply supervisory responsibilities. It means, what are you doing to positively influence people around you and to make the whole greater than the sum of its parts? So, yeah, I'm very big into leadership. This book is all about self-leadership and leading others.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And then my last question, and you gave me permission to ask this in the pre-chat, but your bio says that you've written articles about the future of healthcare. And I mentioned to you that healthcare costs are one of the things for my listeners that are absolutely top of mind. It's very difficult right now. If you have a modest income, the price of healthcare is just outlandish. So in your opinion, where do you see healthcare headed?
You know, it's so difficult to say, and I mean, healthcare reform is difficult to project, whether it's some version of Obama or another version. I think one of the things that will take place is making healthcare affordable and available to more people is going to be at the core of almost everything that we come up with. The reality is too many people are without. If you're asking, what do I think will take place? You know, we talked about it before. It's difficult, if not impossible, to project. I believe that we'll see a very interesting next several years. And I hope that we'll see a time when more people have access to healthcare and hopefully affordable healthcare. But saying exactly how we're going to get there, I learned a long time ago, there are a lot of complicated issues in the world. One of them, just like world hunger, is healthcare, especially in the United States.
Well, they've got a long ways to go to make it affordable for more people, because unfortunately, I think what's happened in the short term is it's become a lot less affordable for for some people who are really working hard. Tim, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom with us on Profit Boss Radio. I'm pleased to have an expert on career management and how to master your career. And I hope everyone will go out and pick up a book of The Compass Solution. And we appreciate your time while you're on vacation.
Thank you, Hillary. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Profit Boss Radio. If you liked it, share it with an artist or creative that you love. And whether you're a painter or a mathematician, may you have all the freedom and prosperity you want.